Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tom Giordano. You are in the linkage retention workshop session for adolescence, focus on adolescence, okay? So if this isn't where you want to be, I won't be offended. Get up and go somewhere else. So I am I'm at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. I'm an HIV clinician and researcher. I am not an adolescent provider, so I assume that there are a number of adolescent trained providers and experienced providers in the room, and I just want to put that out there. I hope you guys are happy to contribute, all of you. I don't have slides. My plan for this was to really make this about sharing best practice rather than and learning from each other rather than lecture. I think there have been plenty of lectures. The discussion at the lectures has been just fantastic. So there's clearly a ton of expertise in the audience here, and so I think we have a real opportunity to learn from each other. And that was what I was hoping to do today for this hour. We're sort of small enough group that I thought maybe it would make sense for just to say who you are, what your clinical role is, where you are, and just real quick, just so we have a sense of who people are and the kind of expertise and roles in the room. So if we could do that without too much ado, I think that'd be helpful. Do you want to start in the front?
Sure. I'm Michelle from Rutgers New Jersey Medical School. I'm an ID physician and associate medical director for our HIV clinic. And we are an adult HIV clinic, but we have found that our retention is lowest among
that is not a unique experience. I guess they're trying to record these sessions, so perhaps hand the microphone along as we... Sorry. I know they asked me if I wanted to stand at the podium or be mic'd. I really didn't want to do either, but so be it.
All right. I'm Consuela Drayton, and I'm a registered nurse from the Medical University of South Carolina, and I'm the nurse coordinator for our pediatric and adolescent HIV clinic.
I'm Shauna Applin, and I'm in Tacoma, just south of Seattle, and we're an FQHC, and we do have primarily adult patients, but again, our data shows this is our lowest group, our 18 to 24, and we're desperate for strategies to keep them in care.
Mm-hmm. I'm Kim Rivers. I'm a nurse practitioner from Nashville. I work for an FQHC. We just opened Nashville's first LGBT clinic and just started in HIV care August 1st. Doing PrEP for about a year. We're co-located with Nashville's largest ASO, Nashville Cares. This is a one-stop shopping. We're targeting young African-American MSMs.
My name is Steve Crow. I've worked in public health care in Austin, Texas since the 90s. I work for the David Palve Health Center there. I also work for another FQHC providing primary care and family medicine, where we usually refer to the David Palve.
My name is Erin Wust. I'm a registered nurse. I work at the Hope Center in Macon, Georgia. I do targeted case management with focus on medication and appointment adherence. And I also work with a research study that focuses on adherence that's a partnership between Mercer University and the University of Connecticut.
I'm Nicholas Jarrett. I'm an infectious disease fellow at the University of Minnesota. And I have a continuity clinic at the Positive Care Center, which is part of Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis.
I'm Michelle Ogle. I'm a pediatrician by trade. I don't do pediatrics anymore. I do ID primarily. I'm in North Carolina, and I'm the director of a dedicated HIV clinic in rural North Carolina. And we provide care for adults and adolescents, and I primarily do the adolescents in our clinic.
I'm Lorraine Sanders. I'm a nurse at Sand Hills Medical Foundation in South Carolina. We're also FQHC. I'm a quality nurse for our Ryan White program, and we do find that our 19 to 24 are they have the less rates for retention and care.
And I'm Makondo Shimokoa. I'm an ID physician from rural North Carolina as well. I work for an FQHC, and our data has also showed we have very low retention rates in adolescents, I guess, aged 18 to 24.
Hi, my name is Marilyn Martinez. I'm here from Greater Philadelphia Health in Action. We are one of the biggest QFC in the eastern part of PA. We see 1,000 patients. We are a comprehensive clinic. We provide dental, primary care, women's health, behavior health. So we're very blessed. We are trying to increase our adolescent population, and that's why I'm here.
Hello, my name is Hermione Bell, and I'm from the metropolitan Atlanta area, and I work at Positive Impact Health Centers, and we are a comprehensive HIV clinic that provides mental health, substance abuse counseling, as well as HIV care, and we do have a rapid start program. And your talk today, there were questions about how do you get meds for people, so I can share that information.
Good afternoon. My name is Philip Chiliad. I work, I'm an infectious disease trained physician, and I work for HRSA HIV/AIDS Bureau, but on the global, the PEPFAR side of our house. And so for PEPFAR, adolescent identification, linkages, retention, adherence is important. So I just want to hear what's the best practice from the domestic program.
Hi, I'm David Rosenthal. I'm the medical director for a young adult and adolescent HIV program at Northwell Health. We have 18 hospitals, and I focus in basically locations in Long Island. And we've opened dedicated services in an LGBT organization, and also have opened a satellite office in Queens due to the low number of resources that were there at the time.
My name is Kristen Wagner. I'm an infectious disease physician. I practice in an FQHC setting, and also have experienced low linkage and retention issues among young adults and youth. For that reason, we partnered with the Fenway Institute to develop an LGBTQ program within our FQHC that would provide other services that might be of importance to that population.
Hi, I'm Ara Fernandez. I'm a pediatric infectious diseases physician, and I'm the director of the pediatric and adolescent youth HIV clinic, and we face the challenges of having difficulty retaining some of the youth, and I'm here to pick somebody else's brain.
Thanks. I'm Adam Zweig, and I'm an internal medicine physician, and I'm medical director of the San Diego AIDS Healthcare Foundation office.
Good afternoon. My name is Janika Robinson. I'm a nurse practitioner from Savannah, Georgia, and I work at Orion White Clinic, and just here just to get feedback and dialogue on retention and care for our youth and young adults.
I'm Catherine Dort. I'm a family nurse practitioner from the University of Virginia, and I'm privileged enough to work with Becca Dillingham and Karen Ingersoll.
Did you make note of my shout out
I
to their app?
Text.
Okay, good.
We're always looking at ways to retain people in care.
Yeah.
And I have perinatally infected like adolescents, young 20s that they're so difficult to keep in care.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Edward Kayondo from Lower Community Center in Massachusetts.
That's cool. That's fine.
I'm Jennifer Burchard. I'm a nurse practitioner with the Christiana Care Health Services. I'm the clinical coordinator for our early intervention program, so we get a lot of people within a week after diagnosis, and this population is very hard to get them to come back to us, especially in Delaware where we're very small and we give pretty much all the care there. So.
Hi, my name is Johnny Cummings, internal medicine physician, medical director for Erin Henry Community Health Center, one of the oldest community health centers in the country. We're from the Mississippi Delta Rural we have a problem with retention of care with all of them. So all age ranges. And so we're here to gain information, how we can share and go into the market and just get some more information.
My name is Claudette Grant, and I'm with the North Broad Hospital District in Florida. And I'm the program director. We just started the test and treat program in Florida and seen it to be very effective. But, of course, linkage is definitely a part of it, but retention and care is still too early to see the result of the retention. But we do have problems with our youth as far as viral load suppression, and partially because linkage and retention is so important. And so I just wanted to hear more about that, what you guys are doing.
I am Mitchell Handridge from University Medical Center in New Orleans, Louisiana. Same thing, just need help in retaining those in care between 18 and 26 years old.
Very good.
Hello, I'm Ebony Copeland. I'm the director of adolescent medicine. I'm an adolescent medicine physician in the Bronx, New York. And we are just kind of starting up our treatment of adolescents and young adults with HIV within our clinic, and I'm kind of the person who's spearheading that, so that's why I'm here.
Hello, my name is Tamira Neely. I'm a nurse practitioner from Charlotte. We do case management and also working at a clinic, and so we see issues with clients ages 18 to 24 for case management and for ambulatory care.
Hello, everyone. I'm Erica Hayes. I'm the medical director of the pediatric and adolescent clinic at St. Louis Children's Hospital, Washington University School of Medicine. We see patients ages 0 to 24 years, 364 days. And one of our big struggles we've been focusing on in our clinic has been lack of retention and care and virologic suppression of our vertically infected youth who've aged up.
Hi, my name is Tina Simpson. I'm the medical director of UAB Family Clinic as of January of this year. And we are a Ryan White Part D funded clinic.
My name is Diane Campbell. I'm from North Carolina, the eastern part of North Carolina. I'm a gynecologist by profession, and I do a little bit of that. But mostly I am the quality management coordinator, and I also manage about 15 case managers. We've grown from 2 to 15 in the past 5 years, who are primarily focused on linkage and retention of all ages.
Hi, I'm Tawo Ehwan. I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm a family physician, a HIV specialist. I run a clinic with a PA. And we have about 350 HIV patients, and we have obviously the same ongoing issue with the retention and care for that age group of 18 to 24.
Mm-hmm. Hi, my name is Mary Ellen Myers. I'm a nurse at the Positive Health Clinic in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I've been there for 12 years. And again, trying to figure out linkage for newly diagnosed young adults, as well as the transition of those patients that were perinatally infected and are now transferring into adult care is just quite a challenge.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Jerry Field. I work at Manhasset North Shore University Hospital in New York. I'm a nurse practitioner, and we do pretty good with the retention care, but I'm always, you know, interested in hearing other thoughts.
Hi, my name is Nicole Leedy. I'm an adult ID practitioner at the University of Kentucky. I'm med peds by trade, so I see puberty and up. We also struggle with linkage and retention and care in this group.
I'm Todd Jarrell. I'm a new medical director about 6 months at Coastal Bend Wellness in Corpus Christi, and we were an AIDS service organization for about 30 years, but have only been doing the FQHC side of things for about 18 months now. Mm-hmm.
Hi, my name is Dan Camara. I'm a nurse practitioner I work with AIDS Care Group outside Philadelphia. We do a lot of STD testing and treatment also. We also do Hep C treatment. It's like a one-stop shop. We do dental and we do substance abuse treatment, Suboxone and all of it.
Hi, I'm Christine Silsby. I'm a physician assistant at Northern Nevada Hopes in Reno, Nevada. And we have a
historically Ryan White Clinic, and then we just got our FQHC designation, fully integrated services. Sounds like we have the same problem everybody else does.
Mm-hmm. My name is Ivy Spadone. I'm a physician assistant at Northern Nevada Hopes in Reno, Nevada. Ditto what she just said.
I'm Dave Keatries. I'm a physical therapist from Rutgers in Blackwood, New Jersey. I treat patients at an HIV clinic in southern New Jersey and do research on issues related to rehabilitation and disability in people living with HIV infection, particularly HIV-related peripheral neuropathy.
Hi, my name is John Nelson. I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner and started to provide care to adolescents living with HIV in 1989. And have been in adolescent medicine ever since then. I'm currently the program director of the AETC NC National Coordinating Resource Center, but am doing research and doing a little work with adolescents on a mobile van in Newark.
Sebastian Roos, I'm an infectious disease provider in an FQHC in downtown Baltimore. And the younger guys are the biggest challenge for us to get them into care and to stay in care.
I'm John Vandewey. I'm an infectious disease specialist at the University of South Alabama in Mobile, Alabama. I'm also the program director of our Part D grant there. And as with everyone else in this room, are struggling with the youth and young.
Hi, I'm Asa Lingo, family practitioner and medical director for Family First Health, FQHC in York, Pennsylvania. The newly diagnosed young MSMs are our biggest headache at present.
I'm Elliot Kalawawa, internal medicine physician and chief medical officer at Waikiki Health in Honolulu, Hawaii. And we've been doing HIV for 31 years, and without Ryan White, we've been able to expand our program. But retention is still a big problem throughout all of Hawaii.
I'm Barbara Taylor. I'm an infectious disease physician here at UT Health in San Antonio. I've been working here and in collaboration with Zhaoan in Dallas to look at barriers to engagement in care, particularly for young Hispanic and African American, in Parkland Hospital in Dallas, and I work in our large county hospital here. And so we're interested in trying to move towards intervention and trying to engage people, and would love to hear what people have to say about that. Because thanks to our recent health advisory, we have a problem with engagement for youth, as it sounds like we all do.
Hi, I'm Rosita Roberts from Montgomery, Alabama, Montgomery AIDS Outreach. I am a registered nurse clinic director, a nurse practitioner student, and a shameless plug, we are desperately looking for medical providers in Alabama. So if anybody's interested in moving, please see me after. But we are having problems with retention of all our patients, so.
Hi, I'm Jean Montan, and I'm an AIDS certified registered nurse. I am quality assurance nurse for our HIV program. We have started a group approach for all of our newly diagnoses with a peer, a case manager, and a nurse. We are now also on another project, which we don't find necessarily the youth so much as we do 25 to 45. And we're trying to direct our inclusive back into care for those with unsuppressed viral loads.
Hi, everyone. My name is Marjorie Janvier. I'm a adult primary care and ID physician in Roxbury, Massachusetts. So similar to as with everyone, trying to reach and figure out how to keep our young men engaged.
Hi, I'm Nikki Reagan. I'm a nurse practitioner at Nebraska Medicine Specialty Care Clinic in Omaha. And I actually just work with adults currently, but we do run what we call our family clinic twice, usually about two or three times a month, actually, where we actually have the PEDS ID team that comes from our children's hospital. So we like run a joint clinic together to try and see more from a family approach.
Jeannie snuck in.
Hi.
Hi, Jeannie.
Hi,
Jeannie Curley, I'm a nurse practitioner at Johns Hopkins. I'm director of the adult services. We have both A, B, and C. We have a lot of resources directed at engagement and care and retention and care, and we are still challenged with our young adults. And so we're just looking to share kind of observations and, you know, what we might consider.
I thought I saw you.
I'm Barbara Silver from University Hospitals in Cleveland, and we have A, C, and D, and we also, in particular, similar to everywhere, new infections are growing in youth, and our youth are consistently our worst group of virally suppressed people. So we are trying to put a lot of effort in trying to keep them engaged in care as well. So looking for good answers.
I'm Lisa Navracruz. I'm also from Cleveland. I snuck in late with Barb. I'm at Care Alliance. We are a healthcare for the homeless FQHC. So we have adherence and linkage issues on many of our patients, not just our HIV patients. And I feel like it informs the discussion on both sides, what we learn in Ryan White and what we learn from primary care.
All right, well, great. Thank you for doing that. I hope you guys maybe realize there's some people in the room who you could talk to or you want to talk to who might be from a similar part of the country or from a similar sounding organization. So that was part of the reason I wanted to do that. So let me start with just sort of a summary of the literature that's focused on youth and retention and care, and it's not going to be long because there's really not that much. There's no adequately powered randomized trials focused on youth to improve linkage or retention. They just don't exist. There's some pilot data out there that look promising using motivational interviewing and techniques like that, but there's no fully powered, completed randomized trial focused on youth that I'm aware of. Now, if anyone knows otherwise, please be feel free to chime in and contribute. There are some focused on adherence to medications, but I'm not necessarily going too far down that road with this session. There are some non-randomized data that are available. One was out of North Carolina. Lisa Hightow-Weedman did a project with, as part of a special project of national significance called In Style, and it was dedicated to trying to improve linkage and retention for youth, especially Black and Hispanic youth. And it was part of actually a larger project called one of the special projects of national significance. There's a whole supplement to in which journal is it in? I'd have to AIDS Patient Care and STDs, I think. Published 2011, maybe, something like that, 12, that is out there. So if you just look for that supplement, you'll find a lot of papers on demonstration projects to try to improve outcomes in youth with HIV. And this was specifically targeting youth who were Black and Hispanic. And MSM. I'm sorry, I forgot to say that. Anyway, her project was similar to a lot of the other projects that were part of that. I think there were 8 sites involved. And theirs really tried to address the entire person. So I think that's one of the important lessons, is that if you just focus on HIV, you're going to lose people. It's got to be – you have to talk about their overall well-being and health. And be able to provide services around all those issues. What they did was develop some nice social marketing materials around this in-style theme, made them youth kind of friendly. They actually had youth involved in the design of the materials, brochures, and logos and stuff. And that actually seemed to play a role in it. And then they had very comprehensive case management services. They had some group sessions. One of the things that a lot of the sites did was very, very, almost instead of warm handoffs, hot handoffs. Like really, you found someone with HIV who was in that high-risk group, the youth group, and they would walk them, drive them, over to the clinical team and really do a face-to-face handoff. And that seemed to help with linkage. So this in-style approach is if you just Google it, you'll find her materials online. It's part of the CDC compendium. And then there's that whole supplement that you should look at if you're interested in this population. There's a project that we did with similar, as part of the same funding, where we compared, this was a retrospective study, where we compared outcomes. And there was a natural experiment that happened in Houston where we had a decentralized era where there were no specific youth services. And then we got some funding to do some youth services, so we kind of centralized them under one clinical team. And then we got this additional funding to enhance the services, so we brought in some support groups. We brought in youth case managers that got extra training. We brought in additional strong partnerships with the city and people who were doing the testing to get people into care. And we demonstrated that those centralization of services did improve outcomes. So I think one of the lessons is the more you can have youth-specific services or youth-specific people, the better off you'll be. There's a lot that seems to happen with the relationship between the patient and the case manager and the social worker, and that team-based approach, which is important for all of healthcare, really seems to be critically important for youth. If you go to the CDC, do you guys know about the CDC compendium for interventions? It's a really nice resource. They have people, they do regular reviews of the literature, and then they vet interventions that have been published and say, what's the strength for this intervention? And if it passes a certain bar, they'll actually print a summary of it and publish it on their website. They have 50-something for adherence, or more than that, I think 80-something for adherence to antiretrovirals, and there are about 13 for linkage and retention in care, only a couple that are use-specific. So it's something to keep an eye on. And if you just Google CDC compendium HIV, you'll find it pretty readily. So that's a resource everyone should know about. Some of you guys mentioned you dropped a few little kernels that I want to try to grow a little bit. So I'm going to just kind of ask for some discussion. So someone mentioned where are my glasses? Oh, here they are. I can't read my own writing. Someone mentioned the mobile van for youth. So there was is part of this SPINS project that I mentioned. The group in Chicago was trying to do a lot with a mobile van, and they had some trouble. But they had this really cool Hummer. It was back in the day, you know, and they tricked it out. It was pretty sweet looking. But I don't know if it really made a difference. But someone, I can't remember who it was, mentioned using a mobile van. I think it was on this half of the room. I would love to hear about how that's going, because I could imagine it working really nicely, and I can imagine the youth like trying to stay away from that thing like it's radioactive, because you could, you know, you'll figure out, their friends will figure out what that van is. Who is doing that?
I'm currently doing a mobile van, but it's not specific to HIV care. It's for adolescents. But I did for 4 years work in upstate rural New York using a mobile van to go out and do primary adolescent care. And it was very effective, but it was a rural community, and we actually identified youth who were HIV infected. It's in a rural county in the Catskills where there's a lot of drug use, and there's a lot of adult HIV, and there's a lot of back and forth from primarily the Bronx to that county. There's a long connection between the feed between New York City and there. It's the vans, I think, in general are not great for ongoing primary care, but they're a great way to get people connected to care that, and I think that the bottom line, as you mentioned, having, you know, done this a long time, is that for all of us, and I can say myself, is, you know, going to a clinic or a hospital, there's a lot of intimidation. Mm-hmm. And if you're And especially for adolescents developmentally, and I'm including up to 24, some for males particularly, it goes up beyond that, but are very self-absorbed and what their perceptions of what others will think or see them, they would rather not take that risk. And definitely going to a clinic that when they walk in does not reflect who they are, it's not very welcoming, you know. And so having an adolescent-based program is very important. But at the same time, we'll realize that in a small rural community, in FQHC, you have to be everything to everybody. But one of my recommendations would be to not focus it on HIV, but to, have a lot of the, if you have a lot of adolescents, but also to make it, as Lisa did with In Style, the focus on the whole person and where you are. So as a transgender adolescent, it's what you want are the hormones. You want your body to transition. You don't care about your frickin' viral load. Right. But get that in slowly, but you've got to really build that trust, and you've got to let them know that they are the center of what you're doing. The other is the mistrust of medications, and that's with the viral suppression, is that many don't want to just go in and start on meds, as would necessarily a 45-year-old gay man who's aware of the benefits of antiretroviral therapy. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different components, and it's very hard, and particularly in, I think, the adult clinics where you have older people whom the younger people don't necessarily affiliate or associate with and don't feel that this is who they are.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Those are great comments. One of the things we did when we were revising some of our adolescent clinic was positioned it in a day of the week when the adult providers were all in conference. And so the waiting room was not going to be filled with various age groups. It was a youth-specific clinic, and it was really the only thing going on in the clinic at that time, at least in that part of the clinic. So, and that, whether that helped a lot, I don't know, but it kept the old guys away from the young guys, and I think there's some value to that, both by giving the youth their space and letting the team kind of letting them be more comfortable. Anyone else doing mobile stuff? Yeah, sure. Comment.
So we do mobile stuff. I think that the mobile unit is beneficial in some ways, but I think the most advantageous part of the mobile unit is using social media with the mobile unit. Mm-hmm. Everyone's using geolocalization apps. If you're not, then I think you need to be. So if you don't know about Grindr, Adam to Adam, Jacked, a bunch of them that are out there, that's the way all of the teenagers and young adults are meeting each other. I've had patients that have come to my office for an initial HIV visit, be thrilled with the experience they had, and then I got a call 3 hours later from someone, and they said, well, I've had HIV and I haven't been in care for 3 years. I said, well, how'd you find me? He said, well, so-and-so told me about you. I said, he just came from your office this morning. I said, okay, great. I said, well, how did you guys meet? And he said, oh, we just hooked up. I just found that he found me on Grindr, and I live up the street from you. So I had a second referral that day for a new HIV-positive patient that referral through Grindr. But I don't usually get referrals through Grindr. I usually get referrals because our staff actually is frequenting on Grindr. We do have accounts that are associated with the health system that are clearly identified as HIV testing programs and sites. The key is that people do not want to be approached to the social media apps for to talk about HIV testing and to talk about what's going on. They want to hang out. They want to talk to other people. They may want to talk to you if they know you're an HIV tester, but they don't want to necessarily talk about HIV testing. And so it's kind of building a discussion, having a conversation that's ongoing, and then over time someone will say, what can I do, or how do I get tested, or how do I get PrEP? And you provide education as you're going, but it's creating a conversation. I think increasingly young adults are looking for social interaction through social media, and I think that using the van to position yourself in places where you can do HIV testing in a unique way by having someone simultaneously on the apps kind of saying, this is where we are, this is what's going on, if you want more information, that's a way of kind of keeping yourself mobile, keeping yourself active, and then meeting people through the apps. And I think it's important that you show ID on the app of who you are, that shows a picture and your affiliation with your FKHQ, so they know that it's an official person, but it's not necessarily a health system or a FCHQ account, because that puts you in a different position. So it's an individual account that's used for work purposes only, and you have to have policies and procedures that are very strict around that to make sure that people do not use it for hooking up after hours if they're your staff members. It's important that you create a professional persona through that account where that kind of is used in that way. But I think that mobile apps are mobile vans are helpful, but I think they really need to be, it's all about the relationships. It's about the relationships for
retention, it's about the relationships we're testing. And I think that one of the most effective interventions we did was to embed a large health system resources one day a week in an LGBTQ center, and so they get to, the patients get to, the potential clients get to meet the staff and have low threshold medical intake basically for STI testing and vaccination if they're interested, but not via primary care type of location, but just low threshold medical screening for risk behaviors and things like that that are not necessarily done at the regular pediatrician's or adolescent medicine office. And that allows people to get to know the medical case managers, the physician assistant, and then when they decide that they want to start on PrEP or they want to, if they are diagnosed with HIV, which hopefully we can avoid that situation, or if they're dropped out of care at another HIV location, they can have a trust relationship with providers and with other staff members that then can easily transition to your location where they can see you in a more medical setting. They can, you can provide a full range of services, but they have a significant trust relationship.
Great, thank you. Other thoughts on mobile and mobile app while we're talking about it?
Actually have individual profiles. I try to create different voices for the social media work that I do. So I tend to have some people that are actually reaching out for, they're reaching out mostly to African-American women that sometimes have a voice of an African-American woman because that's who they are and that's the population that they're interested in talking to. If I have someone that's transgender that's reaching out, I try to have representation to talk about trans issues and new things that are coming on in the trans world and new training programs and new resources and shortages of hormones. And if someone's interested in MSM or they're in the MSM community, then creating a voice of someone that's there. So by creating and hiring people that are doing your outreach and linkage work that are kind of members of the various communities you're trying to attract, and each of them keeping slightly independent and unique voices, that allows for them to be their honest self, which is very important to young adults because they don't want to see a boilerplate, yeah, institutional, boring, straightforward response. They want to see someone who they can connect with and have a conversation with. And so by doing that, you allow that individual relationship. And that's why it's really key that you do have very strict protocols on the back end saying this is a work-only use account, but it does represent you at work.
Did you want
to? Yeah, we've been doing it for using these sites for a long time, and we don't do individual. I have one person in a clinic, a young man, that is got permission from Grindr, Adam for Adam Jack, and there's two other ones that he's on, to be on there to advertise free testing, or if you relocated to the area and you're looking for a provider. So we sort of put ourselves out there and leave it up to the individuals to contact us, and they do frequently. A lot of them come for testing. A lot of young people come for screening. And also, a lot of our young patients are also on those sites. So we've been doing it for a long time, and we do have policies for the young man that's on the sites around, you know, what he is allowed to do, mm-hmm, and what he should not do, and we haven't had any problems with that. We also use an app called Betaglide and Marco Polo, and we use that for our patients to be able to, so for like example, I'm not there now, and we had a guy stop by the office, he had something, and they sent me a message on Betaglide, and he was actually in the clinic and can tell me exactly what his issue was. So I mean, it's like 1 minute of what his issue is. So I find that the more touchy, touchy-feely we are and the more accessible we are through the different mechanisms, the easier it is for a lot of young people to connect with us. So we haven't had a problem doing that, and kids love it. Also on that, we have a Facebook page that my case manager is administrator for. You have to be invited to be on it. And some of the young people, they don't always use their name. They use whatever names they want. They do support groups, and she moderates the support group on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they ask questions that they're afraid or embarrassed to ask me in person. They'll ask it to me, because I wasn't going to be honest. They made me do it. Mm-hmm. And then I can answer the question when I get ready, and then I can answer the question directly to right. Mm-hmm. And so it's been really, really good and welcoming, and was feeling really kind of bad because our young people, that's not where we have the retention problems. It's somebody else that is a little bit older. The young people, we try to meet them where they are, and because I love kids and, you know, pediatric by trade, and you said that's that relationship and the fact that I love kids and I'm touchy-feely with them, they
they like it and respond to it. So, yeah, I think that's really important in doing that and having that transition in care for young people.
Thank you. That's great. The mobile, if you're going to go down the road of apps, and I'm not trying to cut the discussion off on this, but if you're going to go down that road, make sure you talk to your corporate, because it's critically important. Jeannie.
So my question is, I know you have procedures, because I have been terribly burned by an incident, and so I'm very nervous about that. So we have procedures and policies, but really, how do you monitor that kind of interaction? To make sure you have a procedure, you have policies, how do you know it's really happening versus not? I mean, you know, it just takes one person.
Is there a supervisor overseeing, spot checking the conversations periodically, that what you would do for any kind of medical review?
So we do have an outreach lead that kind of looks at the different feeds and the different conversations that are going on, that keeps track of it on a periodic basis, and we'll randomly go through and check. Also, I tend to follow through the different, through Facebook and Twitter and those kinds of feeds, which are less hookup-y. I tend to also make sure I'm friends with all of the people that are there that are working, so that's another way to kind of keep voices that are there. And we do have a Facebook page where we do a lot of things and also drive things to the program that way as well. So we do the best we can. It's a difficult mix because you certainly want to represent your institution properly and you certainly want to represent your program properly. But I think that if you only present with a corporate identity, then I think the problem is you're not going to be able to attract and be able to engage with youth. And then you may have a Facebook page out there that people are looking at occasionally, but you're not really going to find positives, and you're not going to really find people that are lost to care. And I think that's really the important part. I have patients that we've lost to care 3 years ago that we're still trying to find through the Department of Health that have reached out to me through Facebook Messenger and private messaged me and said, how can I, get back into care or whatever. I said, let me give you a call. Do you still have the same phone number? They said, no. I said, give me a call at this number. Our medical case manager will set you up for an appointment. Mm-hmm. So we don't discuss HIPAA stuff, obviously, there. And so we say, let's have you call us. But that's a way that some people are looking out, and they will be lost for months or years, and then suddenly they'll reach out again. So I think that we're right on the edge. I have lots of conversation with my institution about this. And we try to really make sure that we're meeting the needs of what we're trying to do to be out there enough for the youth while we're making sure that we're obviously protecting the institution and our program. And it's a delicate balance. You've got to be very I've been a very strong advocate and had a number of meetings with the institution to get us where we are. And we're able to, so far, we've been doing pretty well, and we've made a big impact. Our social impact has really found a lot of our positives through our CDC funded initiative, and the linkage to care and the retention in care has been very helpful for that as well.
I think it's important to really involve our consumers in these discussions and in us understanding, because all the apps have different personalities. Facebook, and according to my kids who are teenagers, Facebook is a workplace. It's like it's official. It's like where you go to sort of see what everyone's doing, but it's nothing interesting on Facebook, right? It's, I got into this college, or what's the homework tonight? And it may be great for the retention and care stuff, but not for the testing piece, right? So you got to kind of know the personalities of the apps, and the audience has to be involved in this. My daughter spent some time working at MD Anderson and a cancer thing for youth, and she came out of it just like, this is just dumb. They don't know what they're doing. They didn't involve the target audience in there, and so all these adults thinking this is really cool, it's not cool at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is the best way to reach you? What is the best way, for if you have a question, how would you like to be able to communicate with us? We have a risk assessment. We have a whole little thing for adolescents and young adults that we do. That's kind of how we find out how they want to communicate and who they want to communicate with. Because a lot of times they do want a more authoritative person to ask certain questions to and to communicate with. So your daughter's right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So I mentioned earlier that our organization partnered with the National LGBT Health Education Center, which is affiliated with Fenway. So there's an overlap in the professionals that work there. And for those of you who don't know this, they have a program funded through the federal government to provide technical support and education to FQHCs. And it's been a very helpful partnership because we've called on them basically to respond to different needs that we saw within the organization to better meet the needs of our LGBTQ youth. So, for example, we had them come in and do a training for our front desk and our front desk staff on the types of things that are important for them to know about the population.
Yeah.
Using correct pronouns, the sort of different body language if they themselves are uncomfortable. And I think, you know, that 1 hour training was very helpful. Mm-hmm. Then we had a separate group come in who had expertise on asking about sexual orientation and gender identity among adolescents, you know, kind of how you ask those questions that are sort of age appropriate and are going to respond to the needs of different ages.
Mm-hmm.
Then I participate in something called TransEcho, which is a year-long program on providing transgender health care. So how can I feel like I'm better equipped to do that from doing hormone therapy to different referrals for gender affirmation surgeries, et cetera. So it's and that's all free of charge. So I think what in the end what that meant for us is that as an organization, we are just we are more welcoming, more affirming, providing higher quality services to both HIV-positive youth and young adults as well as those who are at risk, and mm-hmm. we want equality to engage them. So just a suggestion for those who could want to take advantage of those services.
Yeah, Fenway just got – is this the new grant or the
–
2 years. They just got another grant, and I don't recall the details of it, but they are a tremendous resource. Now, you have to admit what Fenway thinks is going to work, what Fenway knows works in Boston may not work in rural Mississippi the same way. But some of that basic human training is important no matter where you are.
You know, sort of predicated on the fact that we as health professionals want to talk about your sexual health, and so, you know, we want to ask you and we want you to tell us. Mm-hmm. And that's already a wonderful opening to mm-hmm. just general dialogue about sexual health. And it may, you know, HIV may only be a small part of what you want to talk about with any male or female.
Other ideas, best practices that you've tried, they seem to work. I think.
I had a question.
Yeah, sure.
I don't have a best practice, that's why I have a question. I'm interested in text messaging, and you had mentioned like an app-based communication, and I have a very ancient administration that just thinks we couldn't possibly be HIPAA compliant, and so I'm wondering if that's been successful and how, like literally text messaging or going through an app-based program, and if that's been helpful for this age group.
There, just while you move the mic around, there was recently a one or two page JAMA commentary about HIPAA compliant text messaging. It's very difficult to actually be HIPAA compliant and have a text message function. So you do have to be careful about that, apparently. But
just echoing what you said, text messaging by its very nature is not compliant. The SMS protocol does not reach HIPAA standards.
Yep.
If you're going to be able to do anything that looks like text messaging, there are a number of other free apps that are out there that are able to do that, and they do it within a HIPAA compliant context. PingMD is one of them that I've used. It's free. Your patients have to download that just so they can communicate with you. Mm-hmm. There's a number of other ones that are out there that are HIPAA compliant specific apps that are meant for doctor-patient relationships, for known doctor-patient relationships that are there. It's not like find a doctor and ask a question.
Right.
HealthTap and other ones do that. But this is for your patients that want to download the app for free and want to communicate with you. They can connect with you. And so there are apps that are able to do that. I found they're completely useless. Honestly, I've tried. I actually have found them useful to use with my staff, because if I want to actually, if I'm at the hospital and I want to talk to my medical case manager and email's just too slow, being able to open a conversation through one of those apps is extremely helpful. But most of my patients have no desire to download an extra app so they can talk to their doctor. They're just not interested in that. And so I think that I am developing, and there are other people that have developed medication adherence apps specifically that do that. It does need to be driven directly through a HIPAA-compliant backend, and so you need to make sure you're using a backend server that keeps everything HIPAA-compliant. Everything needs to be encrypted on the device as well as on the other direction.
Yeah.
You need to use hashes and certain SMS-based certain coding that gets pretty technical. So you need to reach a very high level of security to do that. And there is a paper that was published out of, was it UVA, I believe, that did talk about a medication adherence app for HIV-specific patients. It came out last year, I think it did.
So that's the I think that's the Rebecca's app, and that they found that the in app communications actually were very useful. They found, and I don't mean to speak for them, but I just had a conference call with her 3 days ago. That it actually downloaded the phone calls that the clinic staff had to try to triage and receive, and you know, voicemails they had to respond to. The people could message them through the app securely, and then they could respond in a timely fashion and didn't have to waste time playing phone tag and trying to figure all that stuff out. So I don't. Your experience is your experience. Their experience is their experience. Everyone's got to try.
I think that the messaging only apps, the third party messaging apps,
that may be the difference. That the embedded in an app that gives you other benefits might make a big difference. That's true. Yeah.
Hi. We're just funded by together with GRI for the Hook Up to Health, just to deal with the young MSM of color. At our clinic, they have a distinct teen group. One kind of funny but very effective thing they have is in their restroom. Within their restroom, they have this board which has this very colorful diary, and then they also have a box so you can just decide to write something over there or just write and then put the note in the box so that the people working in the teen clinic can come and look at it afterwards. But the youth really write stuff on that board in the restroom. So it's something to think about.
I think that raises a point. I mean, that it's hard to remember when we were all teenagers, right? But one of the things that the adolescent psychologists say is that the youth they're trying to express themselves. They're trying to act like adults. They might not always succeed, but having input, they don't want to feel like we're telling them what to do all the time. They want input. They want opportunities to influence outcomes and influence the way adults treat them and everyone else treats them and stuff. So I think that board may be speaking to that.
So I just wanted to address, I work at University of Virginia with Dr. Dillingham.
Please.
And so as a provider, I use the app and my patients use the app. And it started out as a pilot project for new diagnoses. And now it's open to all the patients in our clinic, so it's not just the youth that we're talking about. But any patient can have either if they have a smartphone, our staff will download the app on their phone. And if they don't have a smartphone, we actually can provide the smartphone for them. The patients that already have their smartphone, they can get a $50 stipend each month to help pay for the bills. So it has, in order to keep the cell phone, they have to put in 50% that they have taken their meds. So every day they need to log in that they have taken their meds at 50% of the time to keep it. And then there's a question that they get asked every day that they should answer. But there's also an anonymous board that they can go on and communicate with other people, because we're in a rural area, actually. But they can communicate anonymously with other people in the area for support or just questions and things like that. They can they can send me messages. It does go through somebody else, and it comes through email right now, but we're working to get it into Epic so that you don't have to go somewhere else to look for a message from a patient. It's very clear it can't be an emergency, mm-hmm. When you ask the question. They can send reminders about appointments. All of our phone numbers are already in there, so if they want to contact me or their medical case management. So we find it very effective, and like you were saying, if somebody wants to send a message at 2 in the morning because they're thinking about it at that time, they can do it, and we can get to it the next day.
Rebecca said it also pulls in viral load CD4 data, and so the patients can follow their labs and track and see how things are going, so that feedback is important. Sorry? It's not freely available yet. It's still in development and evaluation phase, but keep an eye on it. And I think Rebecca would be very happy to have people reach out to her with interest in using it. So,
we have
Dillingham is the last name.
We have a pilot in our clinic with our community health nurse who's focusing on really our youth who are not virologically suppressed or they're linked to care. We're not necessarily retaining mm-hmm. them well, and nor do they have the adherence we'd like them to have. And we actually have been doing a secure Facebook messaging. Again, we don't have conversations going on by Facebook, but it's a great way for them to get in touch and connect and then connect offline. I will say another really important aspect for us has been to use an app where the kids can use it on Wi-Fi or a computer or wherever they can get free access, because mm-hmm. often they lose their cell phone service. So it's something they have to use over cellular. Often we're going to lose them, or if they lose their number, they can always go to Facebook and connect up and give us their contact information.
I just want to make two quick comments. One is that the texting too through secure systems is very difficult. But I'm remembering a case that I had a few years ago. That person was connected to me over the phone, had just tested positive, and was a college student who was living with parents, so didn't want to talk. But I talked to him on the phone and then texted, and he texted me all night long. And it, as it came out, it was very, I never mentioned HIV, just back and forth. And it was that he was fearful because he couldn't swallow pills, that he was going to die. So through the texting, I reassured him, he's going to live an old age, don't worry. But in that way, too, it's that immediate connection. Mm-hmm. So kind of like what Lisa, the hot drop-off. But being connected with him all along and doing those extra, as everybody's saying, I know that in some adult medicine, and you wouldn't be here if you felt this way, but that say that the PEDS people coddle the youth, and they need mm-hmm. to grow up, and they need to learn how to make appointments and do that. But the reality is that they're developmentally different, and so we're going to continue to see this without those extra steps. And I don't perceive it as coddling, but being developmentally appropriate for who they are. When they're younger than that, they've got parents or guardians
right.
who we can yell at. But on their own, they are struggling. The other thing I just wrote as another resource, the AATC program developed a resource through the National Resource Center a few years ago, and it's on our website, and it brings together artists. It brings together all of this on linkage and retention, including in style, different ways, patient navigators, safety tips for mm-hmm. training patient navigators, all the different evidence-based models that, are clearly not work for everybody, mm-hmm. but all and guidelines on using social and e-health messaging and connecting to people. There's some useful tips and resources on that in this toolkit on our website. Also, there's a a worksheet for different clinics to utilize in looking at their patterns and looking at what's working, what's not, what are their community-based organizations that are working with them. So it's a worksheet to help everybody individualize, because no one clinic is the same. Mm-hmm. And so it really helps you kind of look at all the different steps, from what are your current rates to what is your population, what is your community, as well as what are your resources. So when there's only two providers, as I've heard in some clinics, versus a whole team with patient navigators, it's very different. So that may be helpful also. And our website is AIDS, ETC, for educationtrainingcenter.org, and you can find it on there.
Great, thank you. We're just about out of time. I'm surprised it went very quickly. We spent most of our time on the mobile apps and mobile outreach, and I think that's probably where we should have spent our time, because that is where the youth want us to be, and we have to figure out how to meet them there. It sounds like some of us are doing that, and some of us it's aspirational. But it's hard to imagine that side of things is going to go away. It's only going to get more. So we've got to figure this out. The point about transitions to adult is a huge challenge for a lot of places, including ours. You know, they struggle through the adolescent clinic, and that's with all the extra support. And then at age 24, a lot of that just is no longer possible. There's just the staff is paid, and it becomes a real challenge. Jeannie, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, so we've had this for quite some time, where the adult, we have staff that work in both clinics. So that has been, so we had a linkage problem from the pediatric and adolescent clinic coming over to the adult clinic. And we're lucky to have enough resources where the adult program is able to fund some support for not just for support staff, but also for physician staff. And so they work in both clinics. And there's the adolescent program actually has, when they're ready to transition out, they have this 1 year, getting somebody ready to talk
mm-hmm.
about it,
mm-hmm.
having the staff come over, the idea that they could still keep their primary care, their clinician, stay with the same clinician, has helped this tremendously. I'm sorry, I don't have the absolute numbers with
mm-hmm.
that. So the linkage or the transition from one clinic to the adult clinic has really been vastly improved with having the staff mingle in both the adolescent clinic and the adult service. So that has worked very well.
Yeah, and if you can't get the provider to be the same, at least some of the staff interfacing so that there's some continuity. But those transition plans are really important. I wish I could say we had that figured out and did it perfectly, but we don't. All right, so it's 4:20 is when this ends, right? It's 4:23. So any final thoughts, final comments? Someone has something they're burning to say and didn't get a chance to say it. Yeah.
I just had a question for others. How many? Because someone talked about, arranging things so that the older patients weren't there at the same time. And I was wondering how many had done that and how helpful that was, because that seems like that would be really a very useful thing.
Yeah, we did that as well.
You do that as well?
We don't call it a teen, it's just the young folks day.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, and actually what ends up happening, even after the teens are adults, I still keep them. Like, they don't want to change providers, so I still keep them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a day just like that where we only have the young people come. Mm-hmm. And it works well.
If that's not possible, sometimes I've heard of clinics where they'll carve out a separate waiting room and try to cohort them that way and create a youth space. Well, all right. Thank you very much, everyone. I hope this has met what you wanted. A lot of shared experiences to draw on. Thank you.